It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Happy Saturday, everybody. In light of what's been going on in the United States this week, we thought we would return to investigative journalist and activist Ida B. Wells Barnett, who spent decades fighting against lynching and advocating for anti-lynching legislation.
Almost 90 years after her death, legislators are still trying to get legislation passed that would make lynching a federal crime, most recently with the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act. That act passed the House in February 2020, but it needs to be reconciled with a slightly different version passed by the Senate in 2018.
This episode originally came out on June 4th, 2018.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
Ida B. Wells Barnett, one of those figures who connects to a lot of our past episodes. She's mentioned in our podcast on Frederick Douglass, and the two of them were colleagues and friends. In our show on the Night of Terror at the Occoquan Workhouse, we talk about her refusing to march in a segregated section of the 1913 women's suffrage progression, instead saying, I am refusing to play by that racist rule and marching with the Illinois contingent with everyone else. She investigated the death of Robert Charles in New Orleans in 1900 and the racist violence that surrounded that. And then the discussion of lynching in our two-parter on the Wilmington coup of 1898 was also informed by her investigative reporting and her anti-lynching campaign. Ida B. Wells Barnett fought against lynching for decades, and this on its own would be remarkable, but she also lived at a time when it was not common at all for a woman, especially a woman of color, to become a prominent journalist and speaker in this way. And then doing this work also meant that she had to speak out very candidly about violence and about rape. Discussing rape at all was a huge taboo, but it was especially taboo coming from a woman. And for a substantial part of her career, she was an unmarried woman, so it was even more taboo. And that is all why we are talking about her today.
Ida B. Wells Barnett was born Ida Bell Wells in Holly Springs, Mississippi, on July 16, 1862. She was the oldest child of James Wells, who was known as Jim, and Elizabeth Warrington, who was known as Lizzie, and they were both enslaved. So Ida was enslaved from birth. Jim and Lizzie both worked for a man named Spiers Balling. Jim was owned by another man but had been hired out to Balling for an apprenticeship in carpentry.
The American Civil War was ongoing when Ida was a baby, and the part of Mississippi where she and her parents lived was no stranger to raids and skirmishes. The Emancipation Proclamation was issued on January 1st of 1863, and while it technically freed her family and everyone else who was enslaved in Mississippi, slavery persisted until Mississippi surrendered on May 4th of 1865, and probably beyond that point, really, as word reached more outlying areas of what had happened. Once they were able to do so, Jim and Lizzie Wells made their marriage legal.
The young Ida Wells was too young to remember the earliest years of Reconstruction. But in general, life was really difficult for the freed people. It was also chaotic as politicians and social reformers tried to work out what to do about the formerly enslaved population and the social and economic conditions that slavery had caused. But the Wellses had a couple of advantages. Jim's owner had also been his father, and Jim had no siblings. And being his owner's only child came with some privileges, including an education.
For a time after the end of the war, the Wellses continued to work for Spires Balling. But then, Balling told Jim to vote for the Democratic candidate in the upcoming election, and Jim had no intention of doing this. As we've talked about before, the Democratic Party at this point was mostly made up of wealthy white slave owners. He intended to vote for the radical Republican candidate. He came back from the polls to find that his employer had locked him out of the workplace.
The fact that Jim and Lizzie Wells were skilled workers rather than manual laborers made it easier for them to find other work. Lizzie and her children also enrolled in school. The family also became politically active, and Ida's father became a member of the board at Rust College, then known as Shaw College, where Ida would go on to study. Ida learned quickly, and she read voraciously, including reading the Bible all the way through, which was the only reading that was allowed in the Wells home on Sundays.
In 1878, Ida Wells' life changed dramatically. She went to visit her grandparents on their farm, and while she was away from home, a yellow fever epidemic spread to Memphis. At first, when they heard about this outbreak, Ida and her grandparents weren't particularly concerned. Memphis had dealt with yellow fever before, and outbreaks had never made it as far from there as Holly Springs, which was roughly 50 miles or 80 kilometers away.
People also blamed yellow fever on miasmas or bad swamp air, so they thought Holly Springs was protected by being on the highest ground in the area. So instead of calling for a quarantine, officials in Holly Springs offered refuge to Memphis residents who were fleeing the illness. But yellow fever is really transmitted by mosquitoes, not by swamp vapor. So once people arrived in Holly Springs carrying the illness, it spread rapidly.
Holly Springs had a population of about 3,500 people, and more than 1,400 of them contracted the disease. More than 300 people died. This included both of Ida's parents, and as soon as she and her grandparents learned what had happened, she took a freight train back to Holly Springs. She went against the advice of basically everyone. Everyone was telling her that it was way too dangerous. There were not even any passenger trains that were running, which was why she was on a freight train in the first place. But there was nobody else to look after her siblings. And by the time she got back home, her baby brother had also died.
Ida's father had been a Mason, and his Masonic brothers came to the family's aid. They started talking about dividing up the Wells children, sending them to live with other families in ones and twos. Ida's sister Eugenia was of special concern. She was paralyzed from the waist down due to severe scoliosis.
Ida was in the room for this conversation, but she wasn't really consulted about these decisions. And she finally told her father's Masonic brothers that they were not going to send any of her siblings anywhere, that her parents would be spinning in their graves if they heard that their children had been split up. She said that if the Masons helped her find a job, that she would look after all of her siblings.
With that, she became both the breadwinner and the head of household. She and her siblings had two legal guardians, but Ida got a job as a teacher so that she could raise and support her five younger siblings. And she was only 16 at this point.
Ida B. Wells kept up her studies while she worked as a teacher and raised her siblings. Her job was at a rural school, so she had to travel back and forth to it by mule. She also started taking college courses at Rust College, although she was expelled from the school in 1881 or 1882. The details of exactly why are not known, but she wrote about losing her temper with the teachers and speaking to them with hateful words.
In 1881, when she was 19, one of Wells's aunts invited her and her two youngest sisters to move to Memphis. By this point, her brothers had both been placed in apprenticeships, and Eugenia had gone to live with another aunt. And this offer gave the Wells sisters the chance to move to a bigger city with more opportunities. And it gave Ida more freedom to pursue her own education and career, since her aunt would be helping to look after her sisters.
It was in Memphis that she really started to become politically active, which we will talk about after a sponsor break.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. The First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courteney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
MTV's official Challenge podcast is back for another season.
And guess what? So are we.
Just in case you forgot, I'm Tori Deal. I'm a six-time finalist and a Challenge champion.
And I'm Anissa Ferrer, and I've been gracing your screens for the last two decades. I am a veteran challenger and Challenge All-Star.
And speaking of All-Stars, All-Stars 4 is finally here.
I'm going to be honest. I literally thought this day was never going to come.
Well, the Challenge gods have answered our prayers, and we're going to be right here along with you fans covering every episode on the podcast.
And this season takes it to a whole new level. Old school legends, modern power players, redemption seekers, and ex-lovers are all competing in Cape Town, South Africa for the prize of $300,000.
Anyone can win, relationships matter, and only one all-star will claim the title of Challenge Champion.
Listen to MTV's official Challenge podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
After moving to Memphis, Ida B. Wells continued to work as a teacher. She had a job in Woodstock, Tennessee, which was not all that far away. She traveled back and forth to it by train. She was very carefully trying to build a middle-class life for herself and her sisters, stretching her teacher's pay to cover things like nice dresses and a comfortable place for them to live. And one of the things that she spent her money on was on first-class tickets in the ladies' car whenever she traveled by train.
The ladies' car was more comfortable than the second-class cars, which were called smokers. The ladies' car was quieter, and it had more comfortable seats. And since she was a young, petite, attractive woman traveling alone, it was also just safer.
She had been going back and forth from Memphis to Woodstock for 2 years without incident in the ladies' car. And then in 1883, she was traveling back to Memphis from Holly Springs on the Chesapeake, Ohio, and Southwest Railroad. The conductor came to take her ticket and told her that she would have to move to the smoker's car.
Wells refused. She had bought a ticket, and she was, as was clear by her dress, her demeanor, and behavior, a lady. The conductor insisted that she would have to move, and even went so far as to move her luggage and belongings into the forward car, expecting her to follow them. When she stayed where she was, he came back and attempted to remove her bodily from her seat.
She once again refused to move. She was, as we said, a petite woman. She braced herself against the seat to keep this man from dragging her away. And when he kept manhandling her, she bit him.
Ultimately, Wells was forcibly removed from the train, with both sleeves torn out of her linen duster. And when she got back to Memphis, she filed suit against the railroad. She was removed from the ladies' car a second time before that suit had even been settled, so she filed another one.
This was kind of on a cusp of segregation by race on railroads. Like, it was a lot more common to have a ladies' car that women could pay additional, you know, an upgraded fare to sit in. And all the other cars were just kind of a mix. And it was becoming more formalized to instead have train cars segregated by race. And this was sort of in the interim of that changeover happening. So a circuit court found in Ida B. Wells' favor under the Civil Rights Act of 1875, and she was awarded $500 in the first case and $200 in the second case. But the railroad appealed the decision, and the Tennessee Supreme Court overturned that ruling in 1887. The Supreme Court's assertion was that Wells had only filed the suit in the first place to harass the train company, and that her actions were, quote, not in good faith to obtain a comfortable seat for a short ride.
That is infuriating. Wells was devastated, and it wasn't just the loss of the case. It was what that loss signified, especially since she had been taking this legal action pretty much on her own without the help of any civil rights organizations or the greater Black community of Memphis. Her case wound up being one of the ones on the road to Plessy versus Ferguson, which we have covered on the show before, in which the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that racial segregation was constitutional.
This whole experience inspired Wells to become more politically vocal. While she was still working as a teacher, she started working as a journalist as well under the pen name of Iola. She wrote about civil rights and she wrote about social issues, and she was eventually nicknamed Iola, Princess of the Press.
By the end of the 1880s, Wells had already written a prolific body of newspaper columns. She also purchased a 1/3 share in the Memphis Free Speech and Headlight in 1889. And eventually, she and one of the other co-owners, J.L. Fleming, bought out their third partner, and they owned and ran the Free Speech together. In 1891, Wells wrote an article that was critical of the Memphis School Board, and her teaching contract was not renewed. She then turned her attention to journalism full-time.
And soon, the focus of her journalism turned to lynching. The catalyst was the May 9th, 1892 lynching of Calvin McDowell, Thomas Moss, and Henry Stewart in Memphis. They had been arrested and charged with maintaining a public nuisance while trying to defend themselves and a grocery store called the People's Grocery from an armed white mob. McDowell was the store's manager, Stewart was the clerk, and Moss was the president of the joint stock company that owned the store.
This incident started with a group of black and white children playing marbles near the store. A fight broke out after a black child won all the marbles. A white man came out and beat the child who had won the game, and a group of black men attempted to intervene. A white mob formed in retaliation, bent on destroying the people's grocery. One of the white instigators actually owned a competing grocery store.
Yeah, they definitely had it in their minds to run this grocery store out of business and to hurt or kill its owners. So after McDowell, Moss, and Stewart were jailed on the public nuisance charge, an armed militia of black men tried to stand guard outside of the jail. It was a known risk if a black man was in jail for something that a white mob could come and take him out of that jail and harm him. So they were standing guard. But eventually, the sheriff ordered them to disperse and confiscated all of their weapons. After they were gone, a crowd of white men, as they had feared, came to the jail. They took McDowell, Moss, and Stewart to a field outside of town and shot all of them.
Wells knew all of these men. She was friends with Tom Moss. And she, along with the rest of the black population, was terrified, especially since the sheriff secured a court order authorizing him to shoot any black person who seemed to be causing trouble on site.
Even though Memphis had passed a law banning the sale of firearms to its black population, Wells bought a pistol and she carried it in her purse. But she also recognized that that pistol was only going to go so far to defend her. In the pages of the free speech, she became one of the many black voices urging the rest of the black population to leave Memphis. And there was actually a mass exodus out of Memphis. It was big enough that it set off an economic crisis as black business owners and laborers fled the city.
After this incident, Wells began researching, investigating, and writing about lynching. This was the work that she would pursue for most of the rest of her life.
Almost immediately, this work led to Wells being threatened with lynching herself. On May 21st, 1892, she published an article in the Free Speech that started out with a statement that 8 men had already been lynched in the span of just a week. 5 of them had been accused of rape. She went on to write, quote, "Nobody in this section of the country believes the old threadbare lie that Negro men rape white women. If Southern white men are not careful, they will overreach themselves, and public sentiment will have a reaction. A conclusion will then be reached, which will be very damaging to the moral reputation of their women."
This was basically the same argument that would appear in the Wilmington Daily Record in 1898. That these rape allegations were stemming from consensual relationships between black men and white women. That was the article that was used as justification for the Wilmington coup and the mass racist violence that followed it. And Wells's article sparked similar outrage, although it did not launch a massacre.
A few days later, a white paper called the Daily Commercial responded to Wells' article, and here's a quote, quote, "The fact that a black scoundrel is allowed to live and utter such loathsome and repulsive calumnies is a volume of evidence as to the wonderful patience of Southern whites, but we have had enough of it."
Similar sentiments ran in other papers, and a mob of people convened at the Cotton Exchange building in Memphis, intending to lynch both co-owners of the Free Speech. But Wells had gone to Philadelphia to attend the African Methodist Episcopal Church's General Conference, and from there she went on a trip to New York rather than returning to Memphis. J.L. Fleming had also left town for fear of his life.
While Wells and Fleming survived, the Free Speech didn't. The mob sacked its offices and destroyed all of their equipment and furniture.
After this incident, Wells followed her own advice, and she left Memphis. She didn't even go back to try to get her belongings.
We will talk about her life after leaving Memphis, after a sponsor break.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess. The 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again. the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances. And the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same exact set of seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Minnie Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including actress and star of the mega hit sitcom Friends, Courtney Cox.
You can't go around it, so you just go through it. This is a roadblock. It's going to catch you down the road. Go through it. Deal with it.
Comedian, writer, and star of the series Catastrophe, Rob Delaney.
I shouldn't feel guilty about my son's death. He died of a brain tumor. It's part of what happens when your kid dies. Intellectually, you'll understand that it's not your fault, but you'll still feel guilty.
Alt-rock icon, Liz Phair.
That personal disaster wrote Guyville. So everything comes out of a dead end.
And many, many more. Join me on season 3 of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. Now, this is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. If you ever felt like you were always too much this while also never being enough that, this is the podcast for you. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more via my own personal stories, along with interviews with inspiring thought leaders from our community. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community that you need to know. So much of what makes our community so beautiful is our diversity, yet too often those of us who don't fit into this dumb stereotypical box of whatever it means to be Latino are left without a voice or just forgotten about. On this show, I celebrate the uniqueness of our culture and invite you to walk in your authenticity. Listen to Life as a Gringo as a part of the My Cultura Podcast Network, available on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Even though Ida B. Wells left Memphis behind, she did not back down in her writing against lynching after all of this happened. She published a response to what had happened in the New York Age on June 25th, 1892. And then a lot of that response became her pamphlet, Southern Horrors, Lynch Law in All Its Phases. This pamphlet is one of the most well-known of her many, many written works. It started with a letter of praise from Frederick Douglass saying of his own efforts related to lynching, quote, I have spoken, but my word is feeble in comparison.
To quickly recap, lynching is the extrajudicial murder of someone who has been accused of a crime or other wrongdoing. Between 1882 and 1968, there were more than 4,000 recorded lynchings in the United States. More than 70% of the victims were Black, and many of the white victims were civil rights workers or other people who tried to defend Black citizens. Most of these happened in the South, and they were a way to terrorize the Black community and violently reinforce white supremacy.
By the time Ida B. Wells started her anti-lynching work, a false idea had been well established within the white community, and that idea was that Black men were raping white women and that lynching was necessary to discourage these rapes. Wells tackled this idea head-on, countering that there were consensual relationships between Black men and white women, like we alluded to before the break. She wrote, quote, "Hundreds of such cases might be cited, but enough have been given to prove the assertion that there are white women in the South who love the Afro-Americans' company, even as there are white men notorious for their preference for Afro-American women."
She also documented multiple instances of the same pattern. A Black man accused of a crime, then removed from his jail cell by a white mob who murdered him and desecrated his body. She wrote about the disenfranchisement of the Black population in the South through racist voting laws and how that was contributing to the problem. And she picked apart how white newspapers were participants in this violence as well, repeating the same unproven and sometimes completely fabricated allegations about the victims of lynching as though they were fact, often using racist and sensationalized language to do it.
In Southern Horrors, Wells also wrote about the need for the Black community to protect itself since no one else was willing to do it, writing, quote, "The lesson this teaches, and which every Afro-American should ponder well, is that a Winchester rifle should have a place of honor in every Black home, and it should be used for that protection which the law refuses to give."
She made the point that this wasn't about the law. The people who carried out these lynchings were not interested in punishing all alleged rapists, only the Black ones. Lynch mobs weren't operating within any kind of legal framework, and they were celebrating the murders they committed with things like postcards depicting the hanged and desecrated bodies of the victims.
After the publication of Southern Horrors, Wells spent some time in New York City, and then she went to the United Kingdom for an anti-lynching lecture tour. She wrote about her travels in a dispatch called Interocean, including how, for the first time, en route to Britain, white passengers treated her with, quote, "the courtesy they would have offered to any lady of their own race." But she also remarked that some of them seemed to be courteous to her in order to shock the other white people around them.
Wells returned from the United Kingdom to take part in a boycott and protest of the World's Columbian Exposition in 1893, also known as the Chicago World's Fair. As we've talked about on the show before, these fairs were celebrations of a very particular aspect of American progress, that being white progress. The Chicago World's Fair left Black Americans almost entirely out of its exhibitions, and what representations there were demeaning. Also, apart from janitors, porters, and laborers, the fair only had two Black employees. Both of them were clerks.
So, Ida B. Wells, Frederick Douglass, F.L. Barnett, and J. Carlin Penn published a pamphlet called "The Reason Why the Colored American is Not in the World's Columbian Exposition," which was basically an explainer written for fair attendees with an introduction in English, French, and German. It walked through the many social and political issues affecting the Black population, and then it detailed a lengthy back and forth with organizers, basically going back and forth about including Black people in the fair, that showed discrimination against the Black community at every step.
Ferdinand Lee Barnett, co-author of this pamphlet, attorney and founder of Chicago's first Black newspaper, would go on to be Wells's husband. It's not clear exactly when they met or how their courtship began. Wells had, from her teenage years, had lots of suitors, and by her 30s, she was frustrated that she was not yet married, and the fact that she wasn't caused a lot of suspicion about her morals. Black women were heavily stereotyped as promiscuous, and Wells's work meant she was often in the company of men, so she had to constantly defend herself against malicious gossip.
Some of this was, like, malicious gossip published in newspapers as fact. It wasn't just people talking about her behind her back. For a time, this courtship was long distance. Wells returned to the UK in 1893 and 1894 to continue her anti-lynching tour. She was really finding a much more receptive audience to her work in the UK than in the US. She helped found the British Anti-Lynching Committee, which started launching other anti-lynching groups and working with British clergy to get their American colleagues on board.
Ida B. Wells and Ferdinand Barnett married on June 27, 1895, when Wells was 32. She was so well known by this point that the New York Times mentioned her wedding in a small feature at the bottom of the front page.
That suspicion and criticism of her personal life that had been going on while she was single didn't really stop after Wells Barnett's marriage, though. Other activists, including Susan B. Anthony, criticized her for getting married. Susan B. Anthony basically told her she shouldn't be messing around with some man when she had important work to do. But unlike a lot of the white women who were activists and were choosing not to marry, Wells Barnett did not come from money or have other family to help support her in her work. She also just wanted to be married and to have children. She and Frederick had each found in one another a partner that they could trust and who could work with and support the other in the civil rights work that they were both doing.
And their marriage was not exactly conventional. Wells Barnett hyphenated her last name rather than taking her husband's. And her work and travel did slow down a little bit as she raised children. She and Ferdinand had four kids together, and he had two from his marriage to his late first wife. But she did not stop working, and sometimes she traveled to speaking engagements with the babies and a nurse.
Wells Barnett continued her anti-lynching campaign for much of the rest of her life, and she also advocated for other causes. She called for a kindergarten in Chicago that would enroll black children. She was part of the movement for women's suffrage. And in addition to investigating and spreading awareness of the lynching of black men, she did the same for lynching, rape, and sexual assault of black women.
She also butted heads with a lot of other leaders in these spaces. She was described as difficult, headstrong, stubborn, temperamental, and prickly. She helped found multiple civil rights organizations, but she often didn't become an ongoing member in the face of these personality conflicts, many of which were likely due to the fact that she was not behaving as was expected of a woman.
Yeah, it's pretty well agreed upon that if she had been a man, a lot of the things that people criticized her for would have instead been seen as assets. She also called out both black and white activists for their complicity or their missteps. This included ongoing disagreements with Booker T. Washington, whose work was a lot more focused on the idea of giving black citizens the tools and education to help themselves, not on advocating for changes to the law or aggressively fighting back against injustice. She really saw his approach as too conciliatory and too tolerant of white racism. And she finally cut ties with him after he refused to denounce a particularly horrifying lynching.
She also called out past podcast subject Jane Addams. On January 3rd, 1901, Addams published an essay in The Independent called Respect for the Law. This essay clearly and definitively condemned lynching, but it also gave the people perpetrating these crimes a lot of the benefit of the doubt. She wrote, quote, "Let us assume that the Southern citizens who take part in and abet the lynching of Negroes honestly believe that it is the only successful method of dealing with a certain class of crimes." And later she went on to write, quote, "Let us give the Southern citizens the full benefit of this position and assume that they have set aside trial by jury and all processes of law because they have become convinced that this brutal method of theirs is the most efficient method in dealing with a peculiar case of crime committed by one race against another."
Jane Addams, in a lot of ways, when it came to racism and racial discrimination, in a lot of ways, she was really progressive. And this was not a case where she was really progressive. And, you know, Ida B. Wells Barnett knew her and worked with her. They were both living in Chicago. She published a rebuttal on May 16th. So Wells Barnett started out by praising Jane Addams and saying that she was reluctant to diminish the impact of what Addams had done. Addams was a well-known, well-respected white woman who was condemning lynching, and she was doing so with a dispassionate and logical argument. So this just was not something that most white leaders in the United States were doing. So Wells Barnett made it clear that if every white activist wrote a similar essay, the nation would be in a much better place.
But from there, Wells Barnett directly criticized the assumptions that Adams had rested her argument on. She pointed out that giving the perpetrators of lynching the benefit of the doubt as, quote, doing what was best was dangerous and damaging. She also picked apart, once again, the idea that the victims of lynching had committed rape, using the Chicago Tribune's annual lynching statistics to back up what she was saying.
Wells Barnett was present at the founding of the NAACP, and at its first meeting, she gave a talk called Lynching, Our National Crime, which incorporated her, at that point, almost 20 years of research and advocacy. To sum it up, quote, first, lynching is color line murder. Second, crimes against women is the excuse, not the cause. And third, it is a national crime and requires a national remedy. So although she did continue to participate in the NAACP's work at various points, she wasn't listed as an official founder, and she eventually distanced herself from that organization.
In spite of Wells Barnett's lifelong work, there was no national remedy for lynching. Although some states passed laws against lynching, Southern Democrats blocked efforts to pass laws at the national level. The protections Wells Barnett was fighting for were finally included, at least on paper, in the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
By that point, Wells Barnett had been dead for more than 30 years. She died on March 25, 1931, at the age of 69. At the time of her death, she had been working on her autobiography, which she started on about 3 years before. She was motivated, in part, to write this autobiography by attending a Negro History Week event in Chicago. They were discussing a book by Carter G. Woodson, who was one of the first scholars of Black history. Like, that was becoming a field, and he's recognized as one of the first people doing this work. His book that he had written on the topic made no mention of her anti-lynching work at all. And she realized that if she wanted her life and work to be documented, she was going to have to do it herself.
Her youngest daughter, Alfreda Duster, edited this autobiography, which is called Crusade for Justice, and it was published in 1970. And the book came out just as there was an increasing focus on both Black history and women's history in the United States. It helped bring Wells Barnett's work and accomplishments back to the forefront of the national consciousness.
Yeah, and those decades between her death and when the book came out, she kind of faded into the background. She wasn't included in a lot of discussion about Black history. Today, there is an Ida B. Wells Barnett Museum at the Spires Balling House. The Ida B. Wells Barnett House in Chicago is a private residence, but it's also a National Historical Landmark. And the National Memorial for Peace and Justice, which is a memorial to the victims of lynching and racist terror, opened on April 26, 2018 in Montgomery, Alabama. And we will end with a quote that sums up both what made her such a force to be reckoned with and why people describe her with words like prickly. That makes me angry, but I also know that people describe me with words like prickly, so I feel like a tiny bit of kinship with her. Although she is far beyond my abilities. Anyway, in 1909, a man had been lynched in Cairo, Illinois. And according to a 1904 Illinois law, a sheriff whose prisoner was lynched had to be removed from his position, and then he had to apply for reinstatement. So the sheriff who was involved with this lynching, I don't know if he was directly involved, but the man had been taken from his jail while he was the person in charge. He had applied for reinstatement, and Wells Barnett went to Cairo and successfully got that application for reinstatement denied. So the Springfield Forum had this to say on December 11th of that year, quote, Ida Wells Barnett is to be highly lauded for her courage and magnanimity. She towers high above all of her male contemporaries and has more of the aggressive qualities than the average man. It belittles the men to some extent to have a woman come forward to do the work that is naturally presumed to be that of men. But Mrs. Barnett never shrinks or evades. She is a heroine of her age, and the nation is better off for her having lived in it. Long live Mrs. Ida B. Wells Barnett. I love that quote. Thank you so much for joining us today for this Saturday Classic. If you have heard any kind of email address or maybe a Facebook URL during the course of the episode, that might be obsolete. It might be doubly obsolete because we have changed our email address again. You can now reach us at historypodcast@iheartradio.com, and we're all over social media at Missed in History. And you can subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, and wherever else you listen to podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I used to have so many men.
How this beguiling woman in her 50s...
She looked like a million bucks.
...scams a bunch of famous athletes out of untold fortunes...
Nearly $10 million was all gone.
It's just unbelievable.
Hide your money in your old Richmond, because she is on the prowl.
Listen to Queen of the Con, Season 5, The Athlete Whisperer, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What up? I am Dramos, host of the Life as a Gringo podcast. This is a show for the No Sabo kids, the 200%ers. Here we celebrate your otherness and embrace living in the gray area. Every Tuesday, I'll be bringing you conversations around personal growth, issues affecting the Latin community, and much more. Then, every Thursday, I'll be tackling trending stories and current events from our community. Listen to Life as a Gringo on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
From iHeart Podcasts.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
I'm Paul Pringle, an investigative reporter for the LA Times. Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.